The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the October 20th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows kind of a dark room. It might be a hotel room with three men standing. In the foreground is Harvey Weinstein, and back to his left is Bill O'Reilly of Fox News, and back to his right is President Donald Trump. And they're all wearing white bathrobes. And the title says, "See No Evil, Why Powerful Men Get Away with Sexual Abuse." And I think we picked that up on the controversy of the week, but we'll start as usual with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump washes hands of Iran deal. What happened? President Trump was on the verge of decertifying the Iran nuclear deal this week and handing the fate of the agreement to Congress. The administration is required by law to certify every 90 days that Tehran is complying with the 2015 accord, under which the country limited its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Failure to certify triggers a 60-day period for Congress to decide whether to reimpose sanctions on Iran, an act that would essentially scuttle the deal entirely. Trump administration officials hope the prospect of the accord's collapse will force Iran and other signatories, China, France, Russia, Germany, the UK, and the EU, to renegotiate terms. The International Atomic Energy Agency's inspectors say Tehran is complying with its agreement not to develop nuclear capabilities. But Trump, who has criticized the accord signed by President Obama as the worst deal ever, said last week that Iran's expanded ballistic missile program and belligerence in the Middle East runs against the spirit of the deal. The president's decision to decertify came in defiance of the advice of senior Republican lawmakers, European allies, and his own cabinet. Secretary of Defense James Mattis and General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, both expressed support for the deal last week. Prime Minister Theresa May this week phoned the president to urge him to reconsider. Representative Ed Royce, the Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said that while the deal was flawed, the U.S. should nevertheless enforce the hell out of it. What the editorial said: "This is President Trump's most feckless foreign policy decision yet," said the New York Times. "Iran is a bad actor, but the deal is working. It is stopping Tehran from producing a nuclear weapon. While Congress is unlikely to kill the accord this time, many previously critical Republicans now see its value. There are no guarantees what it will do in the future. Decertification will also further alienate our European allies, give Iran an excuse to resume a full-blown nuclear program, and make other nations less likely to negotiate with us in the future. Besides, Trump is already involved in one dangerous nuclear standoff with North Korea. Why risk another?" The president is right to describe this deal as broken, said the Washington Examiner. It imposes no restrictions on Iran's ballistic missile program and doesn't give inspectors immediate access to suspicious military sites. Yet, rather than decertifying now, Trump should use the threat of decertification to get a better deal. He could declare that unless clear and concrete improvements are made, he'll refuse to certify next time. If our European allies balk, he could threaten to impose secondary sanctions on European firms that do business with Tehran. that would prompt a sense of urgency. What the columnist said, I was a vocal opponent of the 2015 accord, said Max Boot in foreignpolicy.com, but decertification is a huge mistake. It will isolate not Iran, but the U.S. The mullahs will never renegotiate a deal that's good for them as it is. If the U.S. abandons this agreement, it would take Iran only about a year to produce nuclear warheads, said Joe Sestak in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The only way to stop them would be a campaign of heavy bombing, but that would trigger a sustained counterattack from Iran that would close oil shipping routes in the Strait of Hormuz, destabilize the global economy, and result in missile attacks on Israel and U.S. military bases in the region. In other words, a major regional war. Actually, this is a strategic move by Trump, said Jonathan Schanzer in TheAtlantic.com. Decertifying will prompt all sides to consider what the deal is worth to them and what they're willing to do to save it. The Iranians don't want to return to economic isolation, and Russia, China, and Europe are the primary investors in Iran's recent economic rebound. So they have little choice but to try to resolve American concerns. Trump can set the terms. That's the best-case scenario, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. What happens if Iran calls Trump's bluff and refuses to negotiate? And neither Congress nor our allies will agree to new sanctions. Let's hope Trump has a contingency plan, because if he doesn't, his administration may wind up with egg on its face. Before we go to the controversy of the week, I want to read you one of the short It Wasn't All Bad pieces. Franz Jacob may look tough with his grizzly beard and tattoos, but for many parents, he's a hero. The Quebec barber recently gained viral status after one mom posted a photo online of Jacob lying on the floor with her autistic son while calmly cutting the six-year-old's hair. Children with autism often don't like to be touched, so Jacob works hard to put his clients at ease and meet them, quite literally, on their level. It's an honor for me to do this, says Jacob, who typically schedules cuts for the kids with disabilities at the end of the day to give them his full attention. And a very sweet picture it is indeed. And now we'll go on to the controversy of the week. Weinstein, why Hollywood liberals were silent. When Fox News CEO, the late Roger Ailes, and host Bill O'Reilly were revealed as serial sexual harassers, virtue signaling liberals were indignant and triumphant, said Alexandra DeSantis in NationalReview.com. Now it turns out the twin liberal bastions of Hollywood and the media were actively ignoring monstrous abuse of women by one of their own. Hollywood mega producer Harvey Weinstein, 65, was fired this week by his own company after the New York Times and the New Yorker detailed 3 decades worth of harassment and sexual abuse allegations against him by a host of young actresses and subordinates, including Ashley Judd, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Angelina Jolie. In the liberal circles in which Weinstein traveled, his twisted inclinations were an open secret, but were ignored. Apparently, many people on the left value political loyalty more than they cherish principle. Now Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and other Democrats are belatedly condemning Weinstein, said WeeklyStandard.com in an editorial. But every member of the liberal establishment, from Washington to New York to Hollywood, should have to answer the question, what did they know about their friend Harvey, and when did they know it? Sorry, said Benjamin Hart at NYMag.com, but Republicans have less than zero credibility on this issue. Last week marked the one-year anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape on which presidential nominee Donald Trump had bragged of getting away with grabbing women's private parts because he was a star, a claim many women came forth to say was true. Did Republicans condemn Trump? Some did for a day or two. But then the party rallied around its candidate, and Trump is now the most powerful man on earth. Do Republicans really want to play this game? Ask Tina Brown in NYTimes.com. Weinstein has just been fired in disgrace. What do they propose we do with the serial sexual harasser in the White House? If we're naming and shaming sexual predators, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com, let's not forget the elephant in the room, one William Jefferson Clinton. During and after his rise to the presidency, Clinton was famously a skirt chaser who was accused by multiple women of harassment and even rape. But feminists and the Democratic establishment decided they could overlook predatory behavior by a powerful liberal man for the sake of the cause. And when the Clinton machine attacked his accusers as nuts and sluts, Democrats also maintained a complicit silence. The good news, said Rebecca Traister in NYMag.com, is that the days of silence may be over. The fact that Weinstein, Ailes, and O'Reilly and Trump were all outed as abusers within the space of a year suggests that something has changed, and that harassment and abuse are no longer excusable foibles of powerful men. Emboldened women are finding strength in numbers and are speaking out. Let's hope so, said David French in NationalReview.com. But the human weakness that enabled powerful people like Ailes and Weinstein to get away with their appalling behavior won't be easily erased. In each abuser's case, his colleagues and underlings ignored or even colluded to hide what they knew because of their personal ambition. Why risk their own careers and face the abuser's wrath to help powerless victims? Wherever money, fame, and power are valued above all else, moral courage is in short supply. So the world inhabited by Weinstein and Ailes, Clinton and Trump, will continue to be the world we live in. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for Sasquatch hunters after legendary primatologist Jane Goodall, 83, said she's open to the possibility that Bigfoot exists. Goodall said she has heard many witness accounts from tribal people of tall, hairy, bipedal primates. I don't want to disbelieve, Goodall said. And it was a good week for robe thieves, with news that the Washington Marriott Wardman Park Hotel is offering previous guests who have stolen items the chance to win a free two-night stay. Applicants must return the item they stole, along with a brief essay that will be judged for creativity and sincerity. But it was a bad week for the U.S. men's national soccer team, which failed to qualify for next year's World Cup in Russia. The team's stunning 2-1 defeat by tiny Trinidad and Tobago this week means that U.S. will miss the tournament for the first time since 1986. It was a bad week for literality after the Food and Drug Administration warned a Massachusetts natural foods company to stop listing love as an ingredient in its granola, since love is not a common or usual name of an ingredient. It was a bad week for trolls after a New York Times report that as a high schooler, White House senior advisor Stephen Miller once jumped into the final stretch of a girls' track race in order to prove male athletic superiority and derided Latino students for speaking Spanish. And finally, it was a bad week for designated driving after the Napa Valley Wine Train, which safely takes tipsy visitors on a tour of Napa Valley vineyards, collided with a stretch limo filled with other wine tourists. No serious injuries were reported. The title of the briefing page article today is Stealing Your Personal Data. Hackers are breaking into the systems of companies, government agencies, and individuals. Is any information safe? How many people have been hacked? So much information has been stolen by hackers that virtually everyone in the U.S. has been affected by a data breach in some way, even those who never go online. The recent data breach at Equifax, one of the three major credit reporting agencies, exposed the personal information of more than 145 million Americans, including Social Security numbers, driver's license data, birth dates, and addresses. As many as 75% of U.S. adults with a credit score may have been victimized. While the Equifax attack was particularly damaging, it was hardly unique. Hackers exposed the personal information of 110 million people in 2013 and 2014, nearly half the nation's adults. In those years, more than 40 million credit and debit card numbers were stolen in a single attack against Target. Yahoo had all 3 billion of its accounts hacked. It's a safe assumption that everyone's Social Security number has been compromised and their identity data has been stolen, said Jeremiah Grossman, the chief of security strategy at the cybersecurity firm SentinelOne. While it may not be explicitly true, we have to operate under that assumption now. Are the breaches getting worse? Yes, almost 2 billion records were lost or stolen worldwide during the first half of this year, up 164% from the last half of 2016. IBM has found that the average cost of a single data breach is now $7.35 million in the U.S. The Equifax hack has already cost the company $4 billion in market value. Spending on cybersecurity is soaring as a result and is expected to reach $90 billion this year and $113 billion by 2020, according to consulting firm Gartner. In 2015, a report by the Atlantic Council think tank and Zurich Insurance Group concluded that while the benefits of online technology will lead to an 8% increase in the size of the global economy between 2010 and 2030, the cost of security will start to outweigh the benefits around 2019. Why is data so vulnerable? Poor security practices are partly to blame. Despite the overall rise in spending on cybersecurity, many companies neglect to keep their systems regularly updated and patched. Equifax blamed a single employee for not installing a software update that would have prevented the breach. Many organizations and government agencies are reluctant to upgrade because of the cost and service disruption involved, leaving so-called legacy technology in place for years. About 7% of computers around the world still run 2001's Windows XP, making it the third most popular operating system. But Microsoft stopped supporting XP in 2014, leaving it highly vulnerable to hackers. Most data is also stored unencrypted. Only 4% of breaches since 2013 have been so-called secure breaches, in which the data involved was encrypted, rendering it useless to those who steal it. Who's responsible? The list of offenders includes state-sponsored hackers, criminal gangs, and hacktivist groups, with the lines often blurring between them. The Chinese have recruited a hacker army estimated at between 50,000 and 100,000 strong, including special military units, that is dedicated in part to seizing valuable data from U.S. companies and government agencies. The Russian military has focused heavily on recruiting hackers wherever it can find them, including from university programs, software companies, and even the criminal underworld. To maintain plausible deniability, the Russian government sponsors hackers, hacker collectives such as Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, which pulled off successful spear phishing attacks against the Democratic National Committee in 2016. Experts say that the Equifax hack appears similar to recent state-sponsored attacks on the insurance company Anthem and the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, with the hackers using tools favored by Chinese intelligence. But it's also getting easier for non-state actors to pull off major attacks. Sophisticated hacking tools can be bought on the dark web for as little as $100. It's increasingly easy for anybody to wield the kind of capability that used to be reserved for nation states or required nation state level of expertise and investment, said Nate Fick, CEO of cybersecurity firm Endgame. Is any defense possible? Technologists are working furiously on new strategies. One idea is to use artificial intelligence to monitor networks for suspicious activity that would otherwise go unnoticed, acting as a digital immune system. Some researchers are developing hardware that's built for security from the ground up, including computer chips that can't be fooled by bogus instructions. But even under ideal conditions, the nature of computing makes attacks inevitable. It's estimated that programmers commit about 50 errors per every 1,000 lines of code. The latest version of Windows is roughly 50 million lines long, and the Android smartphone operating system has 12 million lines of code. Even after rigorous checking, bugs get through. Then there's the potential for human error. Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, made the 2016 Russian hack possible by clicking on a spear phishing link, giving hackers access to his emails. The attackers only had to find one weakness, said Kathleen Fisher, a computer scientist at Tufts University. The defenders have to plug every single hole, including ones they don't know about. Hacking the hackers. With hackers becoming more brazen, some in the security community are advocating that businesses go on the offensive, breaking into their attacker systems to steal back or delete stolen data or even damage their computers. Earlier this year, Representative Tom Graves, Republican from Georgia, proposed a bill known as the Active Cyber Defense Certainty Act that would exempt companies victimized by cyber attacks from laws that prohibit them from accessing other systems without permission. The strategy is controversial. Many hackers commandeer other people's computers and serve to launch attacks, making it likely that the counterattacks could hit innocent systems, creating more chaos in an already chaotic cybersecurity landscape. But hacking back is already being practiced quietly by many businesses, said Davey Ottenheimer, president and security consultancy Flying Penguin. Almost every large organization I consult with has some form of hackback going on, he said. We'll read a few of the columns now. This first one comes from the U.S., Kevin Williamson at nationalreview.com. The purge the GOP really needs. What's a revolution without purges? Asked Kevin Williamson. Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff, Nick Ayers, last week urged major Republican donors to conduct a purge of GOP legislators who aren't on board with the Trump agenda. But what exactly is the Trump agenda? This administration promised to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, but the president has never provided any actual health care policy beyond saying he wants terrific coverage. His tax reform plan consists of a vague set of numerical cuts with no explanation of what loopholes and deductions would be eliminated. And he has no coherent policy on entitlements, the national debt, the border wall, foreign policy, crime, abortion, or anything else. The president has many thoughts about the ratings of various television programs and tweets incessantly about how awful his critics, cabinet members, and other Republicans are. He has been successful at one thing, bringing American politics down to his level, which is childish and emotionally incontinent. We're now supposed to purge Republicans who aren't comfortable with the daily insanity. A purge is indeed needed in the coming years, but it won't be the one that Nick Ayers is contemplating. And this from Canada, how Trump has hurt our TV ratings. Canadians are bored with Canadian television, said John Doyle. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation had its premiere week recently, and the ratings for homegrown series such as Alias Grace and Mr. D were shockingly bad. But it's probably not the fault of the shows themselves. It's because of our increasing intense fascination with the drama that is the United States. Canadian viewership of U.S. series has shot up in the months since Donald Trump was elected president and began pitting American against American. Canadians watch, often gobsmacked, as sitcoms like the new Will and Grace joke openly about how Trump is upending friendships and forcing characters to take a moral stance against the White House. The divisiveness reaches even into late night with a ferocity that is entirely new. Host Jimmy Kimmel, for example, has morphed from jokester to national spokesman for the angry, first helping to tank the Republican effort to repeal Obamacare, and then calling for gun control in the wake of the mass shooting in Las Vegas. As for the news, how can we pay attention to local politics when the man in the Oval Office could start a nuclear war at any minute? The U.S. is drama incarnate. We are watching, transfixed, as a country tears itself apart. And a How They See Us column, sabotaging the Iran deal. Is U.S. President Donald Trump trying to make the world less safe? Asked Sergei Strokin in Kommersant from Russia. His attempts to blow up the Iran nuclear deal could provoke a new security crisis in the Middle East. The 2015 agreement, aimed at preventing an Iranian nuclear bomb, required Tehran to reduce its stockpile of enriched uranium and decommission thousands of centrifuges that could enrich more, in return for lifting of international sanctions and the release of frozen assets. The International Atomic Energy Agency reports that Iran is complying with the deal, but Trump says he won't certify that to Congress, as a U.S. law requires him to do every 90 days. Instead, he has come up with new charges against Iran, claiming that Tehran is financing North Korea and destabilizing the Middle East, thereby violating the spirit of the agreement. But if the U.S. kills the Iran nuclear pact, North Korea will become an even more intractable problem. Pyongyang would have an incontrovertible argument that the U.S. is untrustworthy and no reason to negotiate with Washington. Trump is clueless about the thought and sweat that went into the Iran deal, said Carsten Luther in Die Zeit from Germany. More than a decade of painstaking European diplomacy paved the way for 20 months of serious negotiation, resulting in a historic agreement between Iran, China, Russia, France, the U.S., the U.K., and Germany. Western negotiators had no illusions that the deal was perfect. It was intended to be a first step to freeze Iran's nuclear program short of a bomb and buy time for further negotiations. Yet instead of building on what was achieved, Trump wants to tear it down. What would be the incentive for Iran to agree on joint steps after that? Europe has good reason to be angry, said Shafiq Mandai in AlJazeera.com. After restrictions on trade with Iran were lifted, European firms rushed to do business with Tehran. Airbus, for example, is selling more than 170 planes to Iranian carriers for an estimated $13 billion. If the nuclear deal dies and such investment disappears, Iran's moderate President Hassan Rouhani will find it increasingly difficult to fend off hardline challengers by arguing that the nuclear deal is good for the economy. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has said that all along that you can't trust the Americans. Will he be proved right? Trump is turning the U.S. into a rogue state, said Sarah Mousoumi in Etemad from Iran. His rant against Iran at the U.N. General Assembly last month was filled with insults, falsehoods, and hostility, and dishonored an international body founded to promote peace. President Rouhani, by contrast, gave a statesmanlike address, stressing that Iran would honor its commitments, and representatives of other nations quickly assured him that they would stand by Iran. The U.S. would do well to understand that it is only one country in a multipolar world. Got an interesting change of pace and topic in our in-depth article this week. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. It's called The Real Mr. Rogers. I grew up loving Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, said journalist Anthony Bresnikan, but it wasn't until I had a chance encounter with Fred Rogers as an adult that I realized the character he played on TV wasn't fake. I was putting my four-year-old son to bed one night this past May and scrolling through the news in the dark, finding only more darkness beyond. The horror and heartbreak of the bombing in Manchester, England, were unfolding. Amid the fear and uncertainty, I saw countless instances of selflessness and unity, people welcoming strangers into their homes, taxi drivers helping families get away from the scene, families reaching out to find loved ones who hadn't answered their phones, often finding them scared but safe. Threaded throughout these messages, I saw one meme being shared and reshared. It was something Fred Rogers once said, advice for parents trying to find a way to talk about violence and tragedy with young children. The photo of him is accompanied by these words. My mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. To this day, especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I am always comforted by realizing that there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world. Some wonder if he really said this. Often quotes online that seem too perfect to be true are exactly that. But no, Mr. Rogers really said it. He said it often. Then I scrolled down a little further and found this tweet. 10:21 a.m., May 22nd, 2017. On this day in 1967, a show featuring a kindly man in a cardigan and blue sneakers debuted on public television. Hashtag Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Dr. Paul at Dr. PNY Guard. The date's a little off. He recorded the first episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on September 27, 1967, and it aired nationally in February 1968. But that notion of 50 years hit me hard, and it stirred up a memory of him from long ago. Fred Rogers was from Pittsburgh, my hometown, and I'm a member of just one generation that grew up loving this man, who taught us to be kind above all and see ourselves as special and good, no matter what the world tried to tell us to the contrary. When I got older, I learned firsthand that Fred Rogers was the real thing. That gentle soul, it was no act. Mr. Rogers' neighborhood ran until 2001, but I lost touch with it as I got older. That's how it goes. But in college one day, I rediscovered it, just when I needed it. I was having a hard time then. The future seemed hopeless. I was struggling, lonely, dealing with a lot of broken pieces within myself, and not adjusting well. I was a student at the University of Pittsburgh, but felt rudderless. I wanted to be a writer, but received nothing but discouragement from home. Nevertheless, I devoted everything I had to the school paper, the Pitt News, hoping that would propel me into some kind of worthwhile career and future. It seemed just as likely that I'd fall on my face and end up nowhere. On top of that, I was grappling with a loss that I couldn't talk about, partly because I had no one I could talk to. One span of time in winter of 1996 was especially bad. I was angry, alone, unhappy. But walking out of the dorm one morning, I heard familiar music in the hallway. "Won't you be my neighbor?" The TV was playing in an empty common room turned to WQED, which was Mr. Rogers' home station. And there he was, the sweatered one, feeding his fish, checking in with that little trolley that rolled through the wall into the neighborhood of make-believe, and asking me what I had to do, what I do with the mad that I feel. I had lots to spare, still do. It feels silly to say it felt silly then, but I stood mesmerized. His show felt like a cool hand on a hot head. I never sat down, but I watched the whole thing. Afterward, I left feeling better. Several days later, I got in the elevator at the paper to ride down to the lobby of the William Pitt Union. The doors opened, and who was standing there but Mr. Rogers? For real. I thought I was hallucinating for a moment, but there he stood, a slim old man in a big coat and scarf, eyes twinkling behind his glasses, a small case clasped between his hands in front of him. I stepped aboard the elevator, staring, and he nodded at me. I nodded back, I think. Chances are he could sense a geek out coming, but I kept it together, almost. We rode down in silence, and when the doors opened, he let me go out first. Thinking back, there were maybe two others in the elevator with him. University people, perhaps, seeing him out from whatever meeting they'd had. As we stepped into the lobby, I hovered for a moment, building up my courage as they parted company. And with him, how could you not wait and be polite? Then finally, "Mr. Rogers, I don't mean to bother you, but I just wanted to say thanks." He smiled patiently. I imagine this sort of thing happened to him about every 10 feet. Then he said, "Did you grow up as one of my nice television neighbors?" I felt like crying. Yeah, I did. I was his neighbor. He opened his arms, lifting his satchel in the air and beckoning me in. "It's good to see you again, neighbor." I got to hug Mr. Rogers, y'all. I pulled it together. Then we were walking out and making small talk. He asked if I was a student at the university and what I was studying. I mentioned being a big fan of Johnny Costa, who was the piano player on his show. When you get older, you learn to appreciate things like the gorgeous jazz that this old children's TV show featured. Costa, as it turned out, would pass away just a few months later, and we talked about him as we walked, and how Mr. Rogers marveled at the speed of his improvisations on the keys. Then he opened the student union door and said goodbye. That's when I blurted in a kind of rambling gush that I'd stumble on the show again recently, at a time when I truly needed it. He listened there in the doorway. When I ran out of words, I just said, "So, thanks for that, again." Mr. Rogers nodded. He looked down and let the door close again. He undid his scarf and motioned to the window, where he sat down on the ledge. This is what set Mr. Rogers apart. No one else would have done this. No one. He said, "Do you want to tell me what was upsetting you?" So I sat, and I told him the truth. I told him my grandfather had just died. He was one of the few good things I had. I felt adrift, brokenhearted, on top of everything else. This was just too much. I guess Pap had been my version of a helper in hard times, and I was still looking for him, even though I knew he was gone. I like to think I didn't go on and on, but pretty soon Mr. Rogers was telling me about his grandfather and a small boat the old man bought for him when he was a young man. Mr. Rogers asked how long ago Pap had died. It wasn't long, and I was still torn apart. His grandfather had obviously been gone for decades. Now that 21 years have passed since then, I know that pain of losing someone so special shifts to the background, but never really goes away. Mr. Rogers also still missed his grandfather, still wished he was there when he needed him. "You'll never stop missing the people you love," Mr. Rogers told me. His grandfather had given him the rowboat as a reward for something. I forget what. Grades or graduation. Something important. Something he'd worked hard to accomplish. He didn't have either now, his grandfather or the boat. But he had that work ethic, that knowledge and perseverance the old man encouraged with his gift. "Those things never go away," Mr. Rogers said. "I'm sure my eyes looked like stewed tomatoes." At the end, I just said thank you again for about the 13th time, and I apologized if I'd made him late for wherever he was headed. Mr. Rogers just smiled and said in his slow, gentle voice, "Sometimes you're right where you need to be." How long did that encounter last? Maybe 5 minutes? Mr. Rogers was there for me then, but really, he's here for you now, for anyone who needs him. I never saw him again after that, but that helper quote, that's authentic. That's who he was. Mr. Rogers was for real. Over the years, I've learned a lot about the man he was. Some of it was surprising. I never realized when I was little that when Mr. Rogers sat with his feet in the cool water of a pool and invited the singing cop, Officer Clemens, to join him, that was a daring statement about equality. It seemed like no big deal to me. I suppose now that was the point. A white man and a black man chilling out on a hot day with their feet in water. So simple. Such a little thing, but brave in its sweetness. I look back at the way he connected to a little quadriplegic boy named Jeff Erlanger, not by ignoring his disability, but by actively asking him about his electric wheelchair and all the things the boy could do with it. Mr. Rogers saw people. He saw through and around the things that confuse or distract others. He saw these people. He saw me, a struggling young man who needed some kind words. And somehow, in a way that defies belief, he made you believe he saw you too, even if you had never met. His television neighbor. The wonderful news is he's still here. He's still with us now more than ever, since the live streaming platform Twitch is playing all of his old shows, hopefully for a new generation to discover. About 7 years after I crossed paths with him in Pittsburgh, I was living in Los Angeles, working as a reporter at the Associated Press. I was married. I had found that dream job. Things were better. One morning in February 2003, I logged in to read the news and saw that Fred Rogers had died. He was only 74. I sat at my computer with tears in my eyes, but I wasn't crying over the death of a celebrity. I was mourning the loss of a neighbor. Our neighbor. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared on entertainmentweekly.com. Health and Science page now, starting with the rise of obesity-related cancers. Heart disease and diabetes aren't the only chronic health issues obese people should worry about. New research shows that cancers related to being overweight now account for more than a third of all diagnoses of the disease in the U.S. In a review of data from the U.S. Cancer Statistics Database, the CDC found that rates of obesity-linked cancers increased by 7% between 2005 and 2014, a period when diagnoses of cancers with no link to obesity decreased by 13%. The one exception was colorectal cancer, rates of which dropped by 23%. Likely due to dramatic improvements in screenings for precancerous growth. Overall, there are 13 different forms of cancer tied to excess body fat. They include multiple myeloma and colorectal cancer, as well as cancers of the brain, esophagus, breast, ovaries, uterus, thyroid, gallbladder, kidney, stomach, liver, and pancreas. There are many good reasons to strive for a healthy weight, said the CDC's Anne Schutat. Now you can add cancer to the list. Scientists are still working to understand how obesity affects the risk for certain cancers. Research suggests that being overweight triggers chronic low-level inflammation that could lead to DNA damage. Obese people also have higher levels of estrogen and insulin, which are associated with several forms of cancer. Unlocking the body clock. Three American scientists have won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for their work on circadian rhythms, the internal biological clock that controls a living organism's behavior and physiology. The rhythms, which are synchronized with the Earth's rotation, govern a slew of critical functions, including metabolism, blood pressure, body temperature, and hormone levels. While people have been aware of the body's inner clock for centuries, the three Nobel laureates, Jeffrey Hall, Michael Rosbach, and Michael Young, identified the mechanisms behind it. Working with fruit flies, they isolated a gene that encodes a protein that accumulates in cell at night but degrades during the day. They later identified two other genes that contribute to this process. Their findings helped explain why consistently overriding circadian rhythms by working night shifts or exposing yourself to light from a computer screen at night could increase the risk for chronic health issues, including heart disease, obesity, cancer, and Alzheimer's. We learned we are truly rhythmic organisms, Young tells the Washington Post. It's hard to find a cell that does not oscillate in response to these clocks. And as we often do, we will finish out the hour on the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled, "The Vegas Shooter, Why Did He Do It?" A suicide note, a manifesto, a series of social media screeds, said Ann O'Neill and Bob Ortega in CNN.com. Usually within a day or two of a mass shooting, some evidence emerges to explain what drove a warped mind to commit such a violent act. Yet more than a week after Stephen Paddock, age 64, committed the deadliest mass shooting in American history, killing 58 festival goers and injuring nearly 500 from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, investigators have found no answer to the burning question, why did he do it? Paddock had no strong political beliefs or history of mental illness, said Jen Kirby in NYMag.com. A numbers whiz, real estate investor, and dedicated gambler who would bet $30,000 a night playing video poker, Paddock was a loner who was nonetheless said to be considerate of his tenants, family, and live-in girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley. Something, said his brother Eric, went incredibly wrong. Outwardly, the gunman's life in Nevada was utterly unremarkable, said Sabrina Tavernese in the New York Times. Then something seemed to change last October. Paddock added 33 firearms to his arsenal and apparently started scouting out concert stadium venues, including Fenway Park. Investigators are focusing on the possibility that Paddock was suffering from an acute mental illness, said Toby Harden in the Sunday Times from the UK. In the past year, Paddock seemed to have lost a lot of weight and became increasingly averse to human interaction. He was prescribed the anti-anxiety drug diazepam, and Danley said that in the middle of the night, he would moan out and cry, "Oh, my God." Paddock may have killed for the same reason he gambled, for thrills, said Seth Barron in cityjournal.org. He often spent all night in an electronically induced trance at high-stakes video poker machines, chasing the dopamine hit that comes with statistically predictable periodic wins. Over time, the rewards of this compulsion can dim as the brain's neurochemistry develops a tolerance. Paddock may have then turned his methodical mind to a bigger, more thrilling game, mass murder. Indeed, police found a list of numbers in Paddock's hotel room calculating the optimal trajectory and distance of his gunfire to cause maximum fatalities. It may turn out that Stephen Paddock killed all those people just for kicks. Religious freedom, Trump's clear message. No doubt about it, this is the Christian Right's presidency, said Jay Michelson in thedailybeast.com. Under the guise of protecting religious freedom, the Trump administration last week quietly unleashed a barrage of executive actions that erase years of progress for women and LGBT people. First, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the federal government will no longer prosecute employers for discriminating against transgender people. Then he instructed government lawyers to prioritize religious freedom at all times, essentially giving religious organizations the green light to discriminate against gays in hiring. Finally, the administration expanded the exemption rules for the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate, so now all employers no longer have to offer their workers birth control coverage, provided they have a sincerely held religious or moral objection. The Trump administration is sending a clear message to religious groups, said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. Whenever there's a conflict between religious teachings and our nation's discrimination laws, it will side with religion every time. The Trump administration has done the right thing, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. Sessions' legal guidance wasn't a major policy change. It just forcefully reiterated existing religious liberty protections undermined by the Obama administration. The contraception mandate in particular was an assault on religious liberty. There is simply no way employers such as the Little Sisters of the Poor, an order of Catholic nuns, should be dragooned into subsidizing their workers' life choices. Liberals are treating this as an attempt to ban birth control, said John McCormick in WeeklyStandard.com. But the rule tweak will affect only a tiny percentage of American women working for companies with sincere objections to contraception. Liberals have never understood why religious conservatives support a president as unchristian as Trump, said Hugh Hewitt in the Washington Post. Well, now they have their answer. The president has already nominated a raft of solid conservative judicial appointees, the source of the ultimate protection of faith, and last week he proved he'll go the extra mile to protect religious liberty. For many evangelicals and mass-attending Catholics, having the freedom to practice their faith is the central right by far. If Trump backs them on that, they'll forgive him almost anything. And one short note, there are currently 31 megacities with population of at least 10 million people around the world, compared with just 3 in 1975. 6 of the world's 10 largest cities are in Asia, including Shanghai. None are in Europe. And finally, a quote from comedian Dimitri Martin. The other day I was thinking, I just overthink things. And then I thought, do I though? With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to join us again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.